Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's August 13th. Taking a look outside. Let's see. We've got 64 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 63 degrees at the Heber City Airport. And on the phone with us, with an update, meteorologist from the ABC 4 Weather Center, Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Wednesday, Utah. It's time for a look at your Wasatch Back forecast for your Wednesday. We're looking at fire weather warnings in effect for the Wasatch Back this afternoon. That means we're looking at gusty winds out of the south and west, anywhere between 10 to 20 miles per hour, with gusts up to 30 miles per hour. We're looking at humidity levels as low as 10 to 15%. And so that means that the fire danger is very high as we go throughout this afternoon. So that fire weather warning is in effect from noon through 9 o'clock near Wednesday evening across most of the Wasatch Back, including places like Park City and, of course, the Heber Valley. Otherwise, as we look at your forecast, expect plenty of sunshine with that heat out there as well. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the lower 90s in Park City. We'll see our high temperatures into the mid-90s for us as we go throughout the Heber Valley this afternoon. As we go into your Thursday, we're looking at a few more clouds out there for us as we go into the afternoon hours, slightly cooler temperatures, and a chance of a few isolated showers, which would be some great news to help alleviate that fire danger. We're looking at high temperatures in Park City into the mid to upper 80s. Highs will be into the low 90s in the Heber Valley. Again, we will have a chance of a few isolated to scattered showers and thunderstorms across the area. As we move into your forecast for your Friday, we'll expect more of the same, partly cloudy skies with a few afternoon showers and thunderstorms developing. Not looking at a lot of widespread rain. Don't cancel your outdoor plans, but hey, we'll take the chance of a few isolated showers and storms as we know it's been very dry across the region. Highs will be in the mid-80s in Park City for your Friday, with highs in the mid to upper 80s in the Heber Valley. Now, once we get into your Saturday, we'll start off the weekend with a chance of those afternoon showers and storms once again, with highs in the low 80s in Park City. Highs will be in the mid-80s in the Heber Valley, but by Sunday, we're going to be drying things back out again, those temperatures back into the 80s across the air from Park City to Heber Valley. But then we jump back into the 90s in the Heber Valley as we head into your Monday and Tuesday of next week, with high temperatures back into the mid-80s in Park City with lots of sunshine. Let's look at your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up in just a minute, I'll be checking in with one of this year's Intermountain Ski Hall of Fame inductees, Stephen Nyman, along with Alf Engen Museum Manager Manny Nunez, with details about this year's Intermountain Ski Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Park City Manager Matt Diasen to preview this week's City Council meeting, and from the Heber Valley Chamber, Public Relations Manager Jessica Turner with a look at some of the upcoming events. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include journalist Mallory Tenori Tarplay, talking about a new framework for understanding eating disorder treatment and recovery. Then Rochelle Robinette, a certified herbalist and author of the book Naturally, The Herbalist Guide to Health and Transformation, talks about some 80,000 medicinal plants in the world, taking a look at the modern herbalism as a complement to Western medicine. All of that coming up on The Mountain Life, of course, heard every Wednesday from 9 to 10. Taking a look now at some of the news from yesterday's primary elections. Preliminary results for the Park City Council primary show a tight race with more numbers expected today. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has those first round of numbers.
According to unofficial results from the Summit County Clerk's Office Tuesday, incumbent Tana Tolley is leading the primary race for Park City Council with nearly 22% of the vote. Diego Zagara was a close second with 19%. Incumbent Jeremy Rubel was in third after the first round of results, collecting support from 13% of local voters. John Kenworthy was fourth with over 11%. However, Beth Armstrong was only 8 votes behind. Danny Glasser was sixth, 17 votes behind Armstrong. Molly Miller had tallied 8% of the vote for Park City Council, while Ian Hartley had secured nearly 4% Tuesday night. The Summit County Clerk's Office said another round of results will be released Wednesday. It was unclear Tuesday night how many ballots were left to count in the Park City Council primary race. The top four candidates will advance to the general election November 4th. Parkites will elect 2 city council members and a mayor this year. A primary wasn't necessary in the mayoral race because there are only 2 candidates, Ryan Dickey and Jack Rubin. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And taking a look at the east side of Summit County, in the mayor's race, where the top two will advance to the general election. Rory Swenson was leading with more than 43% of the vote. Lynn Wood second with 33%. For Colville City Council, Matthew Boyer received 30% of votes, followed by Jeff Peterson with 26%. Rounding out the top four were Colleen Goodman and Andrew Nelson. Steve Richens is trailing Nelson for the final spot in the general election by just 11 votes. In France's primary voters narrowed the city council race to four candidates. Riley Atkinson led with nearly 30% of the votes. Lindsay Stone and Clayton Query were tied in second with 98 votes apiece, or 19%. Shanna Fryer following with 16%. Hennifer also had a primary to cut the mayoral field from 3-2. Incumbent Kay Richens had more than half the votes Tuesday night, followed by James Rees with 42%. Don Langston was third with 9 total votes. And the Summit County Clerk's Office had another round of results will be released today. Unclear, though, how many ballots were left to count here in the Summit County races. And candidate fields in Heber, Midway, and Charleston will narrow now that voters have cast their primary ballots. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has those preliminary results.
In the Heber City mayoral race, incumbent Mayor Heidi Franco led with just under 50% of the vote, with Councilmember Scott Phillips in second with 43%, according to preliminary numbers Tuesday night. As for the Heber City Council, four of the eight candidates will make it to the ballot for the general election. Incumbent Councilmember Yvonne Barney won 23% of the vote, with Morgan Murdoch and Nick Lopez close behind at around 17% each. Corey Noyes will also likely be on November's ballot with about 11% of Heber votes. They are competing for two seats on the council. In Midway, six people were vying for two city council seats. That field will narrow to four. Star Stratford with 26% of votes, Andy Garland with 25%, incumbent council member J.C. Simonson with 17%, and Janine Probst with 16%. Midway will also elect a mayor this year, but since there are two candidates, no primary was needed in that race. And in Charleston, residents favored mayoral candidate Jan Wilson, who got 51% of the vote. Sean Taylor will also appear on November's ballot. Preliminary results show it's unlikely incumbent Mayor Brenda Christensen receives another term. For Charleston Town Council, incumbent Scott Solemn won 35% of the vote. Another incumbent, Mark Mayer, joins him on the general election ballot, along with Michael Bauer and Brenda Jamal. Two people will be elected. The Wasatch County Clerk's Office only had provisional ballots and cured ballots, ballots with minor technical errors, left to count after releasing preliminary results Tuesday night. Updated results are expected around midday Wednesday. More than 4,600 people voted in primary races across the county. Daniel, Hideout, Independence, Interlochen, and Wallsburg are also electing new leaders this year, but none of those towns required primary races to narrow candidates ahead of November. The general election is November 4th. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Intermountain Ski Hall of Fame will induct three new members later this month. The inductees are Earl Miller. That'll be done posthumously. Stephen Nyman and Lindsay Van in the studio with details. I have Alfangen Museum Manager Maddie Nunez along with inductee Stephen Nyman. Thanks for joining us. Good morning.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Congratulations, you, Stephen, and just apologies to Lindsay. I mean, we've been following her career for so long. I know that she had a meeting that she needed to attend, so couldn't be with us this morning. But maybe, Maddie, you start by telling us just a little bit about how the process works for getting inducted.
Sure, yeah. Anyone can be nominated. It is for anyone in the Intermountain region, so that is Idaho, Wyoming, and Utah. We have a committee who will review all nominations, bring it down to seven, and then we have a committee who votes on that voting panel.
Okay. So when is the induction ceremony happening?
It'll be August 28th at 6 p.m. at the Chateau Deer Valley.
Okay. Tickets still available?
Tickets are still available. $165 for an individual.
All right. And you can get those by going to the Alfangen Museum?
You can go to our website. Yep.
And that's Alfangen?
It's Engenmuseum at ulf.org, or sorry, .com.
Yeah, okay. So, Stephen, you are a three-time World Cup winner, three-time Olympian in alpine skiing, and I also read the longest tenured alpine skier on the U.S. men's ski team. How long was it?
21 years. I made the ski team in 2002 after watching the Olympics here and retired in 2023.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you grew up in Utah, actually kind of as a youngster skied out of the Sundance Resort.
Yeah, my dad ran the ski school there for 20 years. We grew up on mountain. I lived at Sundance. In the summers, we'd caretake and maintain homes, landscaping, essentially. And then in the winter, it was skiing.
Yeah, okay, so he was the ski school director, and then you kind of found your way onto the race team there?
Yeah, race team there, and I became a big fish in a small pond and realized I needed to chase better talent. So in 1998, I hopped up to Park City, and fortunately, the team was really, really good here at that time. We had a lot of talent, and kids from all over the nation came here, and then obviously with the Olympics coming, there was a spotlight, but we had the World Cup here on Seabees, so they made snow early season, and it was just a solid surface, and we got to train on legitimate World Cup surface all year long, so I think that really primed us for the World Cup, and it created a bunch of talent.
Yeah, so did you get to do some forerunning as a kid back then?
Never.
Never. They missed out. So at what point did you decide that it was like, I mean, how old were you when you decided, I want to be a ski racer, this is what I want to do with my life?
I'd say around 14, I was like, I mean, I always loved skiing. But at 8, I dabbled in it, and I really fell in love with skiing at 8. And then at 14, I was like, I'm pretty good at this. And then once I got my license, that's when I started hopping up here and rubbing shoulders with higher quality skiers.
Yeah. You're tall. I think 6'3", 6'4"?
6'4", yeah.
6'4". So did that create any advantage for you as a downhill ski racer?
Ski racing's very unique because you have a ton of varying body types, and there's Beat Feuz, one of the best downhillers ever. He's a tiny guy, but a little bowling ball. And then there's Axel Swindell and myself, who are 6'3", 6'4", very tall, lots of leverage. I have a lot of advantages. I have a lot of leverage. I can pack on more weight. Momentum is a big thing in speed, but I have less I have more wind resistance. I'm a bigger parachute. So it's amazing at how different all the different body types get down to the bottom of the hill within a couple hundredths of each other.
Yeah, sure is. You started off with as kind of skiing slalom. I mean, that was, and then made the transition to downhill. That's a huge jump. How do you do that?
Well, if you look, a lot of the top downhillers had a lot of skill in the technical events, the slalom and the GS. And I won the World Junior Slalom title in 2002, and that's how I made the U.S. ski team. And Sundance isn't a big mountain, but we had great slalom skiers and a great little slalom piece to train on. So I learned a lot of that touch through slalom. But also, we have a back mountain and a front mountain, and I became one of the best gliders in the world. And I think a lot of that touch came from chasing the BYU ski team all over the mountain. And I didn't understand physics or anything like that when I was a kid. But going from the back mountain to the front, there's a big, long, flat cat track. And I always had to try and keep up with these bigger people that had that momentum. And I think that's where I gained that touch for speed.
Yeah. You won your first World Cup race, a downhill in Val Gardena, Italy. And it's obvious you like that course. In fact, all of your World Cup wins are on that hill. Why did this hill favor you and your style?
I'd say that is also an American thing. I'm actually the first American to ever win there, but we have a lot of success there. And I think that's due to the jumps and the blind rolls and the conviction that you have to have on that course. We kind of started the terrain park movement here in the U.S. And growing up in this Intermountain region, I played a lot in the terrain parks, and I grew up watching a lot of the ski movies and becoming comfortable in the air and throwing myself over these jumps and these cliffs and the free skiing that we have here. I think that's what trained me for that course and trained a lot of us. There was a time, I think around 2010, that North America, the Canadians and the U.S., we had 7 of the top 10 spots in Val Gardena, and I think that's because we're so good in the air and we convince ourselves of where to go over all these blind rolls and big jumps. One of those jumps is around that same time flew 88 meters. That's almost 300 feet. That's kind of crazy.
So what does it mean to you, then, to be inducted into the Intermountain Ski Hall of Fame?
It's pretty special. Intermountain, to me, I cut my teeth here. There's so many memories driving from Jackson to Sun Valley to Park City, the old Intermountain Triangle. And I have a house, actually, in Jackson. My mother-in-law lives in Sun Valley, and I live here. So I spend a lot of time all around those areas still. And it's a great place to be. Lots of incredible mountains, lots of exploration, and lots of talent that have come out of here. So it's exciting to see the Olympics coming up and the little group of kids that is being raised in Park City right now with my children, Ted's children, my coaches over the past, their children. So it's going to be fun to see this blossom once again.
Yeah, nice ski triangle that you've got going there with Park City, Jackson, and Sun Valley. Jackson's got kind of like a community downhill. Is that something you've participated in?
Yeah, Ted gets up there as well. It's the Jacksontown downhill, and anybody can enter. They have the fat and baggy division. You have to be in skis over 100 millimeter waist and baggy clothes, so it's not too intimidating. There are people in costumes, and then there's the 90-year-old guys in their speed suits still going after it. So it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
But it gathers a lot of old World Cup talent as well, and it's a great fundraiser for the ski team up there. And every year, everybody, when they finish, they're like, why can't we do this more than once a year? And so I've talked about creating a little series around at least that area with Grand Targhee. That was the first downhill that I ever did. And then on Jackson Hole Mountain Resort, and then they have the old downhill at Snow King. So maybe we can also integrate some stuff here. Let's make it an Intermountain series.
Sure. So 2023, you said, I think you retired. So what keeps you busy now?
I'm still in the ski industry. I'll do all kinds of stuff. I'm an ambassador. I am an ambassador for Sundance, Fisher. I am the team manager at Spider and still an ambassador there. I ski all over the world. I do a lot of corporate skiing, skiing with private clients, and my kids. They keep me quite busy.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive, though, that you can kind of keep that whole ski thing going.
I'm fortunate.
Yeah. Well, congratulations again. Maddie, what can you tell us about the other two inductees?
Sure. Yeah, we have the late Earl Miller, also from Utah, a great ski innovator. Probably most known for innovating the ski brakes as well as the multi-angle release binding. So really known for bringing some safety to the skiing. And then, as you said, very well known in Park City, we have Olympic ski jumper Lindsay Vann.
Yeah. Lindsay, of course, an Olympic ski jumper and a key figure in the fight for gender equality in women's ski jumping, among the first women to compete in ski jumping at the Olympics. And later, and this goes way back, she was one of the plaintiffs that sued the organizers of the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver because women were not allowed to compete. That was with the help of Dee Dee Corradini at the time. And this was crazy. I just wanted to point it out because when I read that she was not allowed to compete in 2010 because, again, women were not allowed to compete, they lost the appeal. But at that time, she held the K95 hill record in Vancouver. I mean, she had even beat the men there, so kind of unfortunate. But again, congratulations to Lindsay, again, somebody who's grown up here in Park City and proved to be an incredible ski jumper.
She also sold me my home I currently live in.
There you go. Maddie, as you mentioned, you can get tickets online. While I've got you here, any exhibits that you'd like people to be aware of at the museum?
Yeah, we just opened our new entrance. We've been renovating that for the last couple of years. So there's some really great ski fashion that's on display. One of the, I don't know if you know this, but your GS suit is on display. So you can come see Stephen in action. We got his full race suit on there, as well as all kinds of fun goodies from the last 100 years.
Yeah, and any plans in the making for how you kind of exhibit the 2034 Winter Olympics coming to town?
We are in talks trying to figure out what that is going to look like right now. We're really excited for the next 9 years and all the fun ways we can play around with it.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
Earl Miller, I think, is really cool. And he invented the first fat powder ski, and that came out of Utah, the Miller Soft. And everybody says, oh, that started in the 90s. No, that was much earlier. And Earl Miller was behind that. And he started his company was based in Orem, right off the freeway there at 8th North, I think. And my brother, Blake, he was a free skier, and they pressed their skis, surface skis back in the day, at the old Miller factory. So I kind of have a connection with all three inductees, or I am one of the inductees, yeah. But the other two.
Oh, very cool. Well, thanks for that. All right, you guys, Maddie Nunez and Steve Nyman. Again, Steve, one of the inductees of this year's Intermountain Ski Hall of Fame class. Congratulations again. The Park City Council meets on Thursday in work session starting at about 4:30. In the studio with a preview, I have City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Hi, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Any comment about the election yesterday?
I guess first, you know, thanks to all the candidates that are willing to put in the time, the effort, the energy. And then to the teams at both the county and the city, putting on a municipal election requires a great deal of effort, technology, security, and then numerous volunteers. City Hall was a polling location. We probably had 10 or 12 volunteers over the past couple weeks. We have to open early, stay open late, make sure we have a secure facility, and it takes a great deal of collaboration. So just impressed with putting on a successful primary.
Okay. On the agenda, let's start with the enterprise funds and cost recovery budget discussion. Are we in the new fiscal year at this point?
We are. That's correct. New fiscal year begins July 1st.
All right. And this discussion focused on specifically, I think, the recreation and ice arena departments. As we know, enterprise funds are required to be self-sustaining, meaning that whatever it costs to operate must be paid for with user fees or other revenue generations to create enough revenue to cover both the day-to-day operating costs as well as the long-term capital needs. Now, the Recreation Department used to be a recovery, an enterprise fund, but couldn't meet the revenue goals, so was put back into the general fund. Is that the plan going forward, or is that what this discussion's about?
I think it's probably a little bit more longer term. It feels really loud. Sorry if I'm yelling, I apologize. Longer term and forward looking, we actually have several different enterprise funds, a waterfront, stormwater, transportation, parking, golf, the ice arena. And many cities and towns handle these differently in terms of trying to provide access, even subsidized services for certain populations. And in our case, every year through the budget process, we have an opportunity to revisit the terms and conditions and the goals of those funds. So council asks for a deeper policy discussion looking forward. And I think we probably haven't done something this holistic in maybe better part of 7 or 8 years. For example, my old community fully subsidized recreational services. We were a lower income community, and we were trying to provide access for older members of our community and a lot of children and youth. And so really just depending on how your community functions and operates and the demographics and then where the funding comes from, it's a policy decision. And so every couple years, the mayor and council sort of step back and have a contemplative discussion about the goals and the objectives, who they're trying to provide access to, and otherwise.
Yeah, so looking at the numbers that were provided in the staff report, revenues for fiscal year 26 are about $3.4 million for recreation, but expenses come in at $5.1 million. So how's that $1.7 million deficit get paid for?
It comes from the general fund, and that's actually, you know, given my previous example, you know, that's fairly common that the general fund will help provide recreational services or transportation services. Park City, though, is a unique environment due to our tourism economy. And so the fact that we're able to subsidize, for example, a recreation fund by almost 70% is an anomaly. If I'm moving around, going to a city manager conference in other parts of the country, and I were to say that out loud, I mean, it would be aghast in the room. Other city managers are likely funding the absolute inverse, which is 70% of that is funded by the general fund, and their only cost recovery is 30%. So the good news is we are reaping the benefits of visitation in the tourism economy, and we can charge user fees for those facilities that help pay for them in a way that is actually very uncommon throughout North America.
Yeah, but like the water fund, which is an enterprise fund, if in fact they didn't meet the revenues, we just see increased water rates, but you're not going to do that here with recreation.
Well, perhaps. There's a bunch of different ways that we could try to assist a self-sustaining fund. And the self-sustaining fund can acquire revenue and does in many different ways. For example, in the water fund, we have user fees. The city pays for water through its own metering accounts. We have grants and other types of state and federal funding. And you sort of put all of these together and try to create a self-sustaining fund. And where there is a gap, typically communities will come in and address that in certain ways. They may raise the water rates. They may apply general fund. They may apply property tax receipts. And so there's numerous ways that we can balance a self-sustaining fund.
All right. Just wanted to make a quick note about the sales tax revenue report. This is specifically for May this year. We saw about a 3.3% drop from the same month last year. Year to date, though, revenues are still about 2% higher than last year. So what do you think when you see that? We're in trouble, or is it just, you know, things are up and down like that anyway?
Yeah, I think that's a fine question. May, I think, is not an indicator. May is, out of all 12 months in the year, May is the smallest month with regard to overall revenue collection. And so being down 3% last year is actually only roughly a $60,000 decrease. So it's a very, very minor amount in the grand scheme of things. Fortunately, though, with this sort of 1 month to go, we are well over $1 million over our estimates for the previous fiscal year. So we have a rigorous estimating and projection algorithm that we work with projecting next year's revenues. We're coming in hopefully over $1 million on our projection, which is intentional. We like to be conservative. But May being the smallest month out of 12, and that's only a $60,000 delta in the grand scheme of things, not worried about that. You know, that being said, there's a lot of competition around us. I spent the better part of last weekend at the Canyons venue, you know, the sort of new music venue there, and it was a wonderful experience, and it was vibrant and shopping and lots of visitors and guests. Everyone's aware of what's happening at Deer Valley East, the base area there, and out at the Jordan Hill, so we have a lot of competition.
Moving on, Park City Forward, Park City's long-range transportation plan, which prioritizes bicyclists and pedestrians above other modes of travel. We had a pilot program on Park Avenue. It sounds like we're going to end that and now just dedicate a bike lane that'll be painted to provide clearer separation between cars and bikes. But this is only going to happen on one side of the street, the west side of the street, going uphill.
I believe it will look, when all is said and done, I believe it will look fairly similar to what it does today, but probably a little bit more dedicated space and less, I'm trying to think about how I put this on the radio without a visual, sort of less dropping of the breadcrumbs. There's a lot of hash marks in the road and transition areas from one part of the bike lane to another part of the bike lane. And I think we can be a little bit more structured in our approach. And that's the recommendation that we're receiving from the transportation planning group. However, we are reporting in on Park City Forward, which is Park City's comprehensive transportation plan. And I use the word comprehensive intentionally in that this is transit, bikes, pedestrians, signage, neighborhood mitigation. It is a huge comprehensive plan, a 10-year plan, has numerous elements, and it's important that we're reporting in on this at least once a year, if not more, and showing the progress that we're making in terms of improving our signage for our transit system, better markings on our crosswalks, more bike lanes in our neighborhoods, improved bus stops that we're working on throughout the community to show that this isn't a plan that just goes on the shelf. It's something that we're putting into action.
So this doesn't happen until next year then, the restriping of Park Ave?
Yeah, I think there was a little foreshadowing on that specific item, but I think there's probably 20 or 30 other items that are reported on in here in terms of signage and speed bumps and better walkways and renovating paths and pathways and trailheads, numerous other types of activities.
Yeah, another improvement there along Park Avenue will include some new high visibility crosswalks, 7th, 8th, and 15th streets. What does that mean, high visibility?
Yeah. Several different tactics. The paint has changed for line painting in the right-of-way over years. It's becoming better reflective at night when you're putting grain and different materials actually in the paint, and it has different adhesives for people that have mobility issues. We are deploying radar feedback signs and signs at the night that can provide reflection to vehicles but then not reflect into people's windows who are living in those areas. So a bunch of different ways that we can improve crosswalks in that location, lighting, signage, and the type of paint that we're using.
Okay, as you mentioned, there's a whole list of other projects. One of those is the 248 State Route 248 Transit Corridor Study, which is reported to be well underway. So when are we going to see some recommendations here?
Well, I think we're going to have a pretty rigorous discussion at the City Council meeting. Quite frankly, I don't know if any decision's going to be made sort of up or down one way or the other, but we are just narrowing the funnel as we're moving towards a preferred alternative for 248. And right now we have two corridors we've been evaluating, sort of the rail trail corridor or just the 248 corridor. And eventually we'll need to sort of pick a path and then pick a mode. We have three modes. We have the bus rapid transit, fixed guideway, or sort of what's called an automated guideway, which is more like a different type of a train or different type of a vehicle. So three different modes, two corridors, and we're sort of narrowing the approach overall. And this process mimics the same process that was conducted for 224, excuse me. We went through a comprehensive planning and analysis stage, an environmental stage, had to narrow which modes and which corridor that ended up with the BRT solution that we could go and solicit federal funding for. This is basically mirroring that. And we are taking into account the fact that if we have the BRT system on 224, we want some type of integration irrespective of the mode that's chosen.
All right, lots of chatter, as I'm sure you're aware, on social media about putting a train back on the rail trail, which, of course, it was once a rail line. Concern about, though, why there and not on 248? I mean, if you want to elevate a train, why not put it where the schools go, where the fields are? I mean, a railway on the rail trail, where does it go? It just ends at Bonanza, and then what?
I think you're right. We would clearly need to sort of like buttress whatever solution that we have in Quinn's Junction with some type of collector facility or a park and ride that gets people in and out of their cars and into the public transit system. So it would have to be integrated. Absolutely. That's a fine point. Where it goes, rail trail or 248, I understand it's a very sensitive discussion, and I think it's something, you know, having been here for the better part of a decade, you know, I've sort of heard this tossed around from time to time, and it's a quandary. You either consider all the alignments and all the alternatives, even if they've been studied before, or you don't, and you rule them out summarily up front. But when you do so, you face an equal amount of criticism for not being comprehensive in your approach and disregarding a viable alternative. And so, look, a lot of the easy things have been done in this community, and I suggest that the mayor and council are being thoughtful and deliberative about ensuring that they consider all alternatives and modes, as opposed to out of the gate saying this one's off the table and then getting a lot of criticism for it later on. This isn't easy. If it was easy, we would have done this a long time ago.
Okay, moving on to the park and ride facilities. Park City and Summit County completed a regional park and ride study. So when will we have some answers about where a new facility should go there at Quinn's Junction or anywhere?
Well, I mean, as a reminder, we have one facility that's operational now that provides express service to both resorts and the Old Town Transit Center, and that's at Richardson Flat. Richardson Flat parking lot is a long-term lease, and it's an environmentally sensitive area, so it has some limitations in terms of ownership, environmental conditions, and access. Access, it's not readily available from Highway 40 visually. It doesn't have an off-ramp. And so we're in a little bit of a quandary about, do we continue to elevate the level of service at the Richardson Flat location, or do we go all in on a new location like the Gordo property that we've talked about on 248 for many years? Or do we even have sort of a two-location scenario where, let's hypothetical say, Gordo is an everyday express level service, some structured facility, and Richardson Flat is overflow, special events. When Deer Valley has their FIS event, or we have Deer Valley's having the Utah Symphony in town, and we have the Kimball Arts Fest the same weekend, and we can put vendors out there, construction equipment, and day trippers. So I think, again, there's a difficult decision to be made here. Do we elevate the level of service at the existing facility, knowing that it has challenges? Or do we go all in on a new facility structured on 248 at Gordo for its advantages? Or do we have this two-location scenario? Herein lies the challenge. It's a difficult decision. No matter what we do, it will be expensive. It will take time. It will require considerable planning, study, and analysis. And it's really just going to be a choice.
And will you have an answer after tomorrow's meeting?
I don't think so. However, we are getting close, and my expectation is, you know, later this fall or even early this winter, we will be identifying a location and what we'd like to see at that location. Clearly, we wouldn't reach any construction this year, but my hope is sort of in the next, let's say, 12 to 15 months, we're actually starting to begin to identify some construction drawings or renderings about what can be done at these at either location or both.
You mentioned the ownership of Richardson Flat. Who owns it?
I believe it's the Larry H. Miller group that owns that property, but it's also within Park City's jurisdiction, where the land use jurisdiction that property is within, and the parking lot is under a long-term ground lease or land lease that was negotiated through the Flagstaff Development Agreement. You would know this better than me, probably 18 years ago or so.
Yeah. I wanted to note that Park City Mountain Resort, a transit center hub, is anticipated there with any redevelopment applications. Have you seen anything from the resort? I mean, are resort officials meeting with city officials to see what's next there in the parking lots? I mean, you would think the resort would want to do something before the Olympics. Maybe not.
Yeah, I think as, you know, speaking professionally as the city manager, I haven't seen any kind of concept or rendering about a new development application. But we are, you know, always working with the team at PCMR, in particular, as recently as the summer. You know, winter is coming. We're beginning to plan for peak days and mitigation and special events. And so they are a deep and valued partner of ours. And everyone from our transit to parking to our streets division and public works and law enforcement has deep relationships with that team. But on the development horizon, haven't seen anything lately. As an individual, as a just, you know, Matt Tyus, living in this community, I'd love to see an upgrade of that facility long term.
All right. Wanted to just real quickly note that a property owner of a duplex in the Silver Meadows development across from the high school wants to sell his deed restricted home on Cook Drive to a friend, but the city apparently has first right of refusal, so owners there can't sell to whomever they like.
No, I think these properties were built almost 40 years ago, and they have deed restrictions that were applied at that time. And the deed restrictions spell out sort of the terms and conditions for resale. And, you know, the owner is seeking to go kind of outside of those deed restrictions in our process for resale of affordable units. And so we're taking that request to the city council, where they have a lot of different options. They can honor the request, they can exercise a right of first refusal and put this unit into the collection of employee housing, or they can sell it to the next and highest person on the waiting list. I think we have several hundred names on the waiting list. And this is not that infrequent. You know, someone who's living in an affordable unit likely knows someone else in this community that could use housing, and they may or may not be on the wait list. They may or may not qualify, and they will make an initial foray to see if they can extend that olive branch to a friend or a family member. So not that uncommon. And the more units that we have over time under the thumb of affordable housing, the more we'll encounter this.
Do want to note, since I lived in one of those units, they were built 30 years ago, and I sold our unit there back in 2003, and a city employee did get to jump to the front of the line. So they do have some preference over just regular folk, huh?
I don't believe so on the waiting list. I'd have to go back and double check. But you know, the organization, Park City Municipal Corporation itself, over the last probably 8 or 9 years, has made a concerted effort due to our challenges in the hiring arena and attrition and transitional employees that are coming and going in recruitment, have made a more concerted effort to build our collection of properties for our plow drivers, for our police officers, for our public works and streets and transit operators. This is becoming more and more an important component of how we provide frontline and essential services in a community that has housing values that we're facing. And so a little bit of a quandary for the mayor and council. They could execute the request, They could follow the existing process on our wait list, or they could put the unit into our collection of employee housing, because we need it. I mean, I have recruitments for police officers and transit operators and plow drivers, and people want to work for Park City. They love this place. They love what they see when they come visit us and they go through our recruitment program. And the next question is, but where am I going to live? And often we can find a temporary place for them, and we'll lose them sometimes 8, 12, 16 months later because they lose their housing. And so it's a difficult decision for the mayor and council.
Okay. I also saw that the Thanes Pathway opened, but again, just traverses along the side of the driving range. Have we put up a protective fence yet?
Not yet. There's some planning conditions that we need to go through. I think we're going to I think it's the Board of Adjustment we have to go through for some additional approvals. But we are contemplating putting some screening there to protect bicyclists and pedestrians on that pathway. And we're doing what we can to mitigate its visual impacts. We are, you know, implementing a more rigorous landscaping program. We are purchasing trees that are larger than we would typically purchase for a new construction project to sort of initially protect things even more, and then adding some netting. So we had some neighbors that were concerned about it, and we had some risk management issues, and we're attempting to taper it. Believe it or not, there's a fair amount of grade, from the driving range all the way to the back. It's almost a 30-foot increase, and it doesn't look like an elevation, and so we're trying to sort of meet everyone in the middle and not put in a huge net that's going to be visually, you know, degrading.
Yeah, a Thanes resident had sent me some photos, and I believe this happened right after a hydrant may have been flushed, so a lot of water coming down that pathway. But what the photos show is that the water going across the pathway and down into the landscaping and the cart path below into the underground parking instead of draining into the gutter. So do we have some engineering problems here?
I don't know. I'd have to ask my engineering division. I'm not sure if it was a leak or was it a rainstorm. It hasn't rained in a long time. So
no, I think it was a hydrant that had been flushed. And that's why, I mean, it was a large amount of water at once. But yeah. I'm just wondering.
I'd have to ask my engineering division, but that'd be the perfect thing to let that individual share our contact information with that individual and have them get in touch with our engineering division.
All right. And we haven't heard much from Park City about the Kimball Arts Center's decision to relocate out of Bonanza Park to Kimball Junction, but now what?
Well, I think obviously there's a fair amount of, you know, initial sort of, you know, disappointment, because we were very hopeful that the Kimball Arts Center would be an anchor for the 5-acre site. And but when we look at what they were offered, it'd be very hard to compete with, you know, double the acreage and a new planning jurisdiction and accelerated timelines. So we do wish them success, but I think their decision shifts some of the vision for the 5-acre site, perhaps, and creates some additional opportunities. I mean, it's only 5 acres, about a fourth of the acreage was going to Kimball, and I think it also, you know, so it opens the door to new opportunities. We could, you know, maybe decrease some of the intensity, some of the visual impacts, provide more open spaces for walking and connectivity in natural areas. So, you know, I think while it's a loss and we were disappointed, we understand that the opportunity that they have to probably go fast, do something super creative in a planning environment that isn't nearly as restrictive as the city's. On the other side of the coin, while we're disappointed, I think it opens up a tremendous opportunity to decrease some of the intensity of that site and maybe further lean into the values and vision that we've heard through the community for the site.
Okay, Matt, I got to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
That's Park City City Manager Matt Dias. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. On the phone now with an update from the Heber Valley Chamber, I have Public Relations Manager Jessica Turner. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
So lots going on. Tell us what we can look forward to coming up.
Sure, we can touch on some of these upcoming events. So the Heber Market on Main is continuing Thursday nights throughout the month of August. That's happening at the Heber City Park. The new main stage is up and running, so live entertainment happening there. It's every Thursday from 5 to 9 throughout the rest of this month. In addition, on Saturdays, we have yoga, complimentary yoga, and an open farmer's market over in Midway at Midway Town Square. Yoga at 9 a.m., farmer's market from about 10 till 1. Get there early if you want to have the best selection of the fruit and veggie varieties that they have out. We've got some additional programming also back at Heber City Park, and that again ties in that lovely new Main Street stage that they've added into the park area there. yoga, complimentary yoga Sunday mornings at 9 a.m., free concerts in the park Sunday nights from 6 to 7. They've called that the Soulful Sunday series. And then free concerts Monday nights as well from 6:30 to 8. And that's going to be more local talent, so Wasatch Back-focused artists. Let's see what else. We've got country swing dancing and line dancing happening at the Sycamore Building every Tuesday from 8 to 11. So the first hour will be focused on a group lesson, and that's for both swing and line. And then the rest of the evening, you can come solo or you can come with a partner or a group of friends and enjoy the music and the dancing.
Okay. Go ahead. You've got more.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. I do. I'll keep rattling them off. Let's see. If anyone's looking for some volunteer opportunities at and around the Jordanelle State Park, this Friday from 8 to noon, the Ross Creek Trailhead, they're going to be doing some trail work there that day. So come on over, park at the Ross Creek Trailhead starting point, and bring any trail work clothes and tools that you may have. They'll have everything else provided there, and you can participate in helping keep our trails maintained and looking good.
Yeah, so will you get free entrance into the state park then?
Yes, yeah. For that activity. Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Let's see. Cheese making at Kohler Creamery is happening August 22nd. They do two classes that day, so you have your choice of either burrata or mozzarella. They offer those once a month, so that is a recurring series. Noteworthy additional items coming up. Let's see, hand-rolled truffle class. So Ritual Chocolate, the beloved Ritual Chocolate, who's started over in Colorado, moved to Park City, found their permanent home over here in the Charleston-Heber Valley area. They are doing hand-rolled truffle class. This is the first time they've done this. It's August 28th. Sign up in advance on their website. Boomerfest is a music festival that happens every year out in Wallsburg at the R.W. Erickson Foundation private property. It's one of three major events they do throughout the year. That'll be August 22nd through the 24th. It's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. They will include the Antique Power Museum, so they'll open up 20 plus buildings of a private collection of everything from antique cars to restored houses, a church building, a cobbler, a print press. They'll have a lot of the machinery up and running, so you can have the music festival component. You can camp on site. They'll have food trucks out there. You can make a whole weekend out of it. And then, of course, the return of Swiss Days. The beloved Swiss Days is coming. It happens every year over Labor Day weekend. It's always Friday and Saturday of Labor Day weekend, and it happens right over in Midway at Midway Town Square. Every year we see growth in this particular festival, and several of the surrounding area businesses will also participate by setting up small booths and other little shops on the perimeter of their properties surrounding that park area.
Yeah, and a few years ago we took that sheepdog championship weekend away from Swiss Days. Has that helped?
You know what? Yes. Although it's a slightly different audience, there's not a ton of crossover. It's just so much traffic in that Midway and Western region of the Heber Valley and Wasatch County. It was a really smart move a couple of years ago to take that Sheepdog Festival and move it to Memorial Weekend. They did that largely to help protect the canines that participate, because Labor Day weekend can be a very warm weekend still, as we're coming off the last few days of summer season. So Memorial Weekend offers cooler temps and just better weather overall for the dogs. But it has worked out well for the tourism.
So somebody coming from, say, the Park City area, I mean, what do they need to know about Swiss Days? I mean, is there some large parking lot where people go and they get a shuttle or?
Yes, and the Swiss Days Festival website has very extremely detailed information as to where to park, what time to arrive, what's allowed, what is not, recommendations, general Q&A to give everyone a really good idea of how to navigate the festival, because we anticipate tens of thousands of people over the 2 days during that festival time frame of Friday and Saturday. They are offering free shuttles, so there are designated parking areas that are a little bit of a walk from the Midway Town Square, but that's intentional because then those free shuttles can get you to and from, and those run all day long.
Okay. Your director, Dallin Kosher, actually having donuts with those who care to stop by. I guess
what happening is it? That right now, know. Actually. Yeah. Yeah, we do that every other month on the second Wednesday of the month. So he spends an hour plus meeting with local residents, local business owners. It's free. You just pop into the visitor center right on the north end of Heber City, right there, 475 North Main Street. It's a very casual conversation, donuts, coffee, juice, time with Dallin, our executive director. He really is trying to understand any wins for the community, any pain points for the community, whether that's residential or as a business owner and representative. And then we have a seat at a lot of different tables, and we sit on a variety of different boards as a collective staff. So then he can take that information, share that with our team, and then we can navigate some of these decisions that are being made by having direct information from business owners and residents. So every other month, the next one will be October 8th at 8:30 at our visitor center.
Okay, and then tomorrow you've got the chamber mixer. This is what, at Heber Valley Railroad?
Sure do. It is, yes. They're going to do it right there at the depot. They've got some really fun elements to the mixer that they're planning for this. It's from 4 to 6. It's free. We highly, highly encourage business owners, business representatives or business managers, as well as residents, come over, check out the railroad, learn more about the Heber Valley Chamber, meet some of our chamber advisory board members and our staff, and understand what it is we're trying to do here within the community. We operate under a directive of unite, connect, and promote across the valley to represent all of Wasatch County and beyond. We have a lot of partnerships, of course, that stretch outside of the county boundaries. So please, if you have availability, stop by for the mixer tomorrow from 4 to 6 at the Heber Valley Railroad.
Okay, just a minute less. The date for the Wasatch Back Business University and the Chamber Luncheon where people can meet the candidates.
Yes, yeah, we've got a little bit of time on these, but September 10th will be the next Wasatch Back Business University. It will be all about branding, so branding for your business, and it'll be held at the Blair Education Center at the Park City Hospital. And that's from about 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Lunch is included, but we just need you to register in advance. You can go to our website to do that. And then the Chamber Luncheon is going to be a Meet the Candidates Luncheon. So following the primary election and the results from last night and many of us discovering it this morning, the luncheon will be Tuesday, September 16th at the UVU Wasatch campus, and it's all about Meet the Candidates from noon till about 1:30.
Okay, Jessica, thanks so much for the rundown.
Thank you.
Jessica Turner is the Public Relations Manager with the Heber Valley Chamber.